So the one thing that I knew about Brenda was absolutely how thorough she is with everything, and her finding that lengthy bio about me that I did not provide is obviously another example of her thoroughness and preparation. For your sake, I hope my talk is as well thought out and prepared as her introduction. So I have to be honest with you guys. I am sort of the plan B speaker in this category, so you're going to get my slides and my perspective on this. I hope we're somewhere close to the mark in terms of what the discussion is that we need to have today. I'm going to go through some of my philosophy and ideas about these ideas with sensors and non-destructive estimates of plant, water, nutrient needs, and those sorts of things. I'm going to use some of the work that I've done in the last 15 years as an example of that, and exactly how that what we've learned from that, and then a couple of future ideas that I think are going to be important. So the title of this talk came from this attribution to Dr. Norman Borlaug. And a friend of mine, the barley breeder at Virginia Tech, has something very similar to this on the wall in his office. And if any of you have spent a significant amount of time with plant breeders, you know this is true, right? Is that they certainly do that. Now, sometimes my friends in the breeding community talk to plants better than they do with people. But that's not throwing stones. That's just saying that's who they're listening to. But I think a large part of what we need to be able to understand in terms of innovations in remote sensing and detection has to do with this philosophy. Are we listening to the right cues? Are we paying attention to the right things? And are we doing it frequently enough and at the right resolution so that it generates the maximum effect? So I wanted to start with a little bit of sort of where we are. And for me, I want to preface this by saying this is where we are not in the exciting research arena, but in the practical on-farm application of remote sensing technologies, right, and sensors. So in general, I'm going to say that today we are mostly limited by what we can see. And when I use that term, I mean our spectral signatures from plants, right? So it has to manifest itself in color, in fluorescence, in biomass, or something like that that we can use. Now, in some ways, that's the low-hanging fruit, right? Those are the things that are quite obvious. In some ways, that's a limitation. In others, that offers us a lot of opportunity, especially in an area where I've spent a lot of my time, which is nitrogen management. With that said, we have a lot of lots of different resolutions to work with. Okay, you go find 30 meter satellite data, 3 meter satellite data, handheld sensors that would measure an individual plant or a portion of the plant or clip on a leaf. All of these different things that we're dealing with, and so you know the issue is complex, and how we put these different technologies together, I think is probably going to be the most important piece of what we get done in the next 5 to 10 years. The same thing with the choice of sensor systems or the integration of those. In other words, it's not necessarily that one is right or wrong, it's just that what I see is that we're going to need to choose the right combination of things that allow us to do what we want to do, estimate what we want to estimate or measure what we want at a time when we want to be able to do it. And so there isn't a one-size-fits-all solution, and I think that's going to be another theme of what I'm talking about. And then, you know, the next step back, and this is a common issue with these technologies that are going to allow us to, based on what we can see, is there has to be some sort of differential between healthy or well-fed or well-balanced or well-watered and the rest of the population that we want to look at. We do our best to utilize systems that allow that differential to not get to the point where it impacts yield negatively on the part that is the target. But in some cases, it cannot be avoided. And I'll give an example of of what happens several times, of what happens to us with early season corn production and those issues associated with side dress timing and the like. But my take home there is that that's a limitation of where we are today, is that we often have to let some degree of stress manifest itself before we can detect it. And we'd be better off if we could avoid that, but today's systems don't have that. They don't provide that for us. So let me give some background and give you some examples of where the program in Virginia has been over the last 15 or so years, and move that on to some lessons learned. Now, in full disclosure, I think you heard it from Brenda, I did my PhD with Bill Ron and a group at Oklahoma State, so you're going to see, if any of you have read that work, you'll see a lot of similarities between what we've done and what they've done. And so I have to admit, you know, I've never been one to look at a good idea and walk away from it just because somebody else thought of it first. Never would never bother me to adapt somebody else's good idea to work in my environment. So in large part, this is what we've done. This is just a sort of the beginning of these calibration pieces, and this is going to look like what you've seen in any of 10 to 15 other talks like this over the last 25 years of, you know, these calibration studies, rate response studies, measure it, observe it, build that after the fact model, right? And we build the same curve that you've seen in more than 20 papers, right? So here's what happens when you measure your your remote sensing values, you incorporate some plant variables like growing degree days or something like that, you regress that with grain yield over a lot of locations, and you build a curve to make an estimate of yield potential based on these sensors. Again, nothing earth-shaking, but this is what we did in this particular case for wheat in Virginia, and just this background. Now, I have to tell you a little bit of the adaptation of this system for those of us in Virginia, because, in my mind anyway, with most research and all of extension, if there's really not a regional component to the answer, then we just need one publication or one person to do these things, right? But for most of what we do have to have this regional adaptation approach and strategy. And so this piece is specific to us in Virginia and our intensive management program. So what our typical program is, with only 30 to 40 kilograms of nitrogen would go out on a crop in the fall. The reason for that is we have a fair amount of rainfall compared to a lot of the places, say, in the plain states that grow a lot of hard wheat. We have a lot of rainfall in the wintertime. We also grow wheat on a lot of sandy soils, CECs of less than 6 in many cases. So we have the potential for lots of leaching. And then my predecessors at Virginia Tech really pushed an intensive wheat management program, which is based on, you know, canopy management and then also nitrogen concentration. And so when we move out to the tillering stage, growth stage 25 in the Zadox methodology, Feeks 3, we do a tiller estimate. So a certain number of tillers per square foot or square meter is directly related to a nitrogen need, and that's just canopy management. Okay, so that's just trying to build the factory for the yield potential that we would develop later. And then the second application, about a month later, which would be adjointing, is based on tissue nitrogen concentration. So that is, in this strategy, actually crawling around on your hands and knees, clipping samples, sending them to the lab, waiting for a week, and then taking an action on that. And I suspect many of you in the room work with farmers, might even be some. Nobody likes to do that in February. That's a lot of work, and the return on investment is not as good as it should be. So we thought, you know, what about we just replace that estimate with simply, our sensor-based strategy, right? So instead of measuring tissue nitrogen, we're going to estimate it and then use that to move on to yield. And in some ways, that's absolutely what we did. Now, I'll tell you that experience, again, will tell you that we tried it at both times. We tried a variable rate application early, and what we found out is if you made a variable rate application early, you would come back in a month, and what would you find? The next application was a flat rate, no matter what you had intended it for it to be, because you had fixed a lot of the variability. And so we picked this strategy because the bulk of our application goes out in that second application. And we're generally somewhere between 100 to 150 kilograms of nitrogen total for the season, so that's fall and spring. So that spring application would be somewhere around 100 kilos. So we did some large plot demos, which I noticed when I walked in didn't exactly come out exactly perfectly in the transition from the software. But let me say that in the validation piece for what we did with wheat, these are 2 to 7 hectare plots that we used a full-scale 20-meter small commercial applicator for, set up with a Green Seeker system to do the validation on this. Now, here's our wheat results, and you'll have to go with me here as I try to explain a little bit of this. What we're looking at is in the top figure. This is that growth stage 30, FEEX 5 nitrogen rate application, as recommended by what we call the Virginia wheat algorithm or our standard tissue test based strategy in the orange bars. And then just below that, the same colors for the same treatments is just in wheat grain yield in kilograms. So when we look at this in terms of nitrogen rate, 9 of the 15 sites had a lower rate with our wheat algorithm compared to the standard. Okay, the standard had a lower rate. In 2 of those, it had a higher rate. Now, if you look at the in terms of the yields, we find a significant difference twice out of these 15 studies. One was higher for the algorithm rate. One was higher for the standard rate. And in fact, in the case where the yield was higher with the algorithm rate, it was also happened to be one of those locations where we put on more N with that strategy. End message to the farmers: what? Same yield, a little bit less nitrogen. How many of these systems do you think became operational in Virginia after we began to talk about this work? The same one, our same research equipment, right? Why is that? Because a 5 kilo nitrogen savings in the same yield is not an economic situation for the farmer. It's not an economic driver. Okay, so let's switch a little bit. And I want to talk to you about corn, because in Virginia, most of our grain crops are grown in a rotation of 3 crops in 2 years. So it's corn, harvested in the fall with wheat planted about a month later, and then that will come off in June, and soybeans planted immediately behind that as a double crop. Now, I also have to make a confession here, is that, you know, I've been in this business, and I know that it's a terrible thing to do to the audience to put 100 numbers on a slide, okay? I'm just going to get that out front right now. This just happens to be where the laziness caught up with me, and I just gave you guys the table. I apologize. But what I did do to try to help you out is to summarize this down here at the bottom. And so the orange circle represents the difference in nitrogen rate between our Virginia corn algorithm, which was developed the same way, just specifically for corn, and then the difference in grain yield. If you look up at the column, you'll find that of the 15 studies that we did for corn, we had the same grain yield consistently, right? And we had about 20 kilograms less nitrogen. Okay, so now, you know, we've introduced this system. We're saving like 25 kilograms of nitrogen between the 2 crops. It seems to be working in both cases. And how many of these systems do you think we have now in Virginia? This is like 2007, 2008. No, we've got 2. We've got our research unit and somebody else that decided this might be fun to play with, okay? So I'm not feeling great about our program here. I'm thinking, well, what's wrong with the delivery piece of it? Well, one of the things that was wrong with it was that our farmers wanted to be able to side dress earlier than what we could use the system with, okay? So I think most of you understand that, especially with these type of NDVI-based optical sensors, pretty much until we hit a level of saturation, the bigger the plant, the better the prediction of nitrogen need and yield potential. So we went back and looked at this and said, okay, can we use this system? Can we tweak the system so that we can go earlier? So this is some of the work that we did published in 2007 to look at the relationship between NDVI and leaf area index in corn. We did this with biomass and a few other things too. And the idea that, you know, we felt like that, you know, anywhere from about point LAI of about 0.5 to 0.6 all the way up to 1.5, we had a fairly linear relationship through there. But again, we're still not able to go before about V5. We looked at whether or not some of these background interferences were a part of that issue, again, trying to drive this earlier in the season so we could make it easier for our farmers. In Virginia, we plant corn, then we plant soybeans, and then we side dress corn, and then we harvest wheat and barley. And it's all in about a 6-week span there. And so there's not a lot of play in the amount of time that can be allowed between those. So it's not that they don't want to, it's not that farmers are sitting home saying, I'm not going to side dress, I want to side dress now. It's that they need to side dress now. So we looked at soils of different hue and different color to see, wet and dry, to look at the impact of that on the sensor readings. We imposed different residue treatments, corn residue, soybean residue, small grain residue, under these, on top of these soils. And what we found was that within a particular soil, wet versus dry, or among soils, we found some differences. Not surprising, right? The background effect, which just emphasized to me, though, the need for what we have always recommended for the nitrogen calibrations is these reference strips. So the values are accurate based on what we measured within a field, as long as you have the references from that field and those moisture and residue conditions. So if you pick a good representative sample that represents the residue level in a no-till field, for example, within that population, there's really nothing. It works just fine. Now, when you go from one to the other, then that creates a problem based on what we saw, especially across these different colors of soils. But again, that's why that local infield calibration was really important. So these are the things we're learning, right? We never got it, right? We never got widespread adoption of this. Now, I'm going to tell you that, you can look through a lot of things, right? So we talked about the return on investment and the savings there. We didn't really get into this, but the algorithm generation and applicability in, I don't know, what was it, Robert, 2004 or something like that, we started to try to regionalize and develop, algorithms that would go across large areas. It never worked very well, and I think that has to do with the specialization of our cropping systems and our soils and our climates. So what this means is that state by state, region by region, we basically had to come up with equations and calibrations that were locally applicable, which meant there wasn't, based on what we had, one thing that was generally adaptable to everything. Too darn complicated, right, to use in some ways. Well, not really. So my answer comes down to this after talking to lots of people. There are two things that are interrelated for me, and that was the answer comes too quickly and from a black box. One of the things that I thought was going to be really intriguing to farmers was the ability to really take a hands-off approach and let the equipment give you the answer and move forward and do it all in real time, and you don't really have to mess with it. And what I found out is they don't like that hands-off approach. When you think about how most of us make decisions, we want the input, the information, and then we want to think about it for a while. We want to, what if I do this or what if I do that? And frankly, at being at the edge of the field, after taking your comparisons to start, and having 5 minutes to assess, well, is this what I want to do in the field? I don't think it's adequate. It's not for Virginia farmers, and we're not from Missouri, but I think that idea and the time to digest it is an important piece of it. The other thing about it is that it's not exactly this simple, but it's a single measure at one point in time. And so when I tell people about this, I describe it in some ways as if it were like a PSNT test, okay? And that is that there's a lot of agronomic interpretation that needs to go into the final recommendation. So if you do your pre-side dress nitrate test, you get a number and they give you a rate, right? But most people will then apply that professional agronomist approach to it, and it's needed. It's very much needed, and it's needed here too. We don't have a robust enough system to take the agronomy out of it, and we shouldn't. Transferability to UAV platforms, cool idea. I can promise you right now our stuff fits right in that red circle in that it's not 100% transferable. We've been working on this for a couple of years. It's going to take lots and lots of tweaks from what we did to make it work. And one of the reasons that I see is the diversity of resolution, sensor platforms, wavelengths, the masks that people are using. I mean, I pulled this up as I was preparing this talk yesterday, admittedly, or at least finalizing it. But these, you know, these are the first things, the newest articles that came up in Google Scholar on this. And guys, I feel like we slapped right back to 1997 with this, in that everybody's looking for, you know, this really refined piece that we, you know, the index that works right, you know, in this little piece, this little niche. And we did this once before in my career. It's probably been done before me. And I'm a little frustrated that we're back again and wondering why we don't all find the same results when we're measuring different things. NDVI with a bandwidth of 50 nanometers is not the same as plus or minus 2. Right? You're just not looking at the same piece of the spectrum. And so we've got some educational opportunities there. Lots of other cool stuff coming down the pike. I don't know how many of you have played with the Arduino kits. This is like the new Erector set for kids that want to build and program, do electronics and programming. But they sell a kit that is an individual plant watering system that you program the board. Okay, for a few bucks, you can go buy this kit that has a soil moisture sensor, the electronic controller that allows you to set the levels at which you'll water, the volume and frequency of water, and then either with an electric pump or just a squeeze on a gravity drip will allow you to, you know, you do this on your desk, you know. And now, honestly, I helped with this, but I have a 10-year-old fifth grader who can do this. Okay, it's and the cost is inexpensive. You scale that up some, and you look at some of these things where we have plants that are engineered to be markers, to be indicators. Green fluorescence proteins are one of those that are very common. This paper is 10 years old, but it's one of those cool things that is very, very sensitive to this. You know, and I think this is just an example of one of the things that we're going to see in the near future are these very high accuracy indicators. Our lab, my lab's not going into any of that, although we're, you know, there's some cool things out there. We're kind of shifting gear with a PhD student, Mike Swash, in the middle of the room here, and some of his projects looking at trying to sense phosphorus availability. Others have looked at plants, at soils. We're going to use cover crops because of where they fit in the rotation. And the justification is this, spatial variability of P. So this is 22 samples on about 7 acres on one of Virginia Tech College farms. And we have interpolated this based on Creedy, I think. But let's look at the difference between the 9 and the 17. Right? So if you took a sample between those two, what would you expect that sample to be? 9? 17? The mean of those two? Who the heck knows, right? And so we're never going to be able to sample at a resolution that we might need in order to really address that. And our management skills and our equipment can actually be better than this. So what Mike's working with some colleagues in biochemistry, are some Arabidopsis mutants that have a disrupted phosphorus accumulation pathway. They originally with accumulation associated with accumulation of phytate. But the interesting thing is that at relatively low levels of P availability, these plants accumulate an enormous amount of P compared to the wild types. So much so that if you look at leaf development, wild type versus our mutant, they basically poison themselves. It interferes with the other ions within the plant. And so what I feel like we can do with this, and here's another example at the top where we have a simulation of what the wild type would be, low soil test, medium, and high, right? So what I feel like we can do is we're where we want to go with this is use plants as indicators. So instead of using a soil test as an indicator, we're going to use the plant to tell us what's, you know, how much is actually taken up. Now the only trick with this compared to what most people would think about is that what we're going to do is low growth equals high soil test fee P and low fertilizer requirement. So it's just opposite of what you think. But, you know, the gene jockeys tell me this is eminently possible. It can be edited in basically any plant that we know the genome of. And so we're going to have some options once we get over all the challenges with the EPA and regulations. My issue with this, though, is we're still on a reductionist approach. We still want to experiment with these things where we, all other things being equal, or this is the only factor we manipulate. And, guys, that's not the world our plants live in. There's an antagonism of these multiple stresses, and that means we have to do a couple of things. We integrate multiple technologies to say that I'm too hot, too hungry, too thirsty, or the last slide. We end up creating a system that has to communicate and be complementary. so that the plant, that we as managers not only know that I'm all three of those things, but if I'm hot and I'm hungry, then that means a different signal than I'm hungry in terms of what our management response would be. Or if I'm thirsty and hungry, that's not, there has to be a different answer given than I'm just hungry or I'm just hot and hungry. Now, I don't pretend to have the answers to that, but I certainly feel like that's the direction we need to move in the next 10 years. That's it for me, Brenda.